Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Cicillo, internationally recognized neuroscientist, and we're talking about his new book, Emergence, a memoir of boyhood computation and the mysteries of the mind. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it, Mark.
Okay. I'm going to be open with the audience. And I didn't expect this, David. I had no idea what I was getting into when I started reading this book. But this is a tough and at times brutal and violent memoir. Did you have any second thoughts about putting it all out there for the public?
No, not really. I guess my mentality is I wanted to share what people who have those kinds of experiences go through. And the outcomes for people in foster care are quite poor. I wanted to share what, you know, to at least through my own personal experiences, to give a sense of why that might be.
It is an amazing story when you're at the end of it, while you're going through it. It was like something out of Charles Dickens. You were born in 1975.
Yes.
I want you to talk about your biological parents first.
Yeah, sure. So my parents were both. Basically, when I was born, they were both living in Albuquerque. My mother's essentially from Albuquerque. My father from Brooklyn. They were drug addicts. They were all up in the 1970s heroin epidemic. They were taking heroin. They were taking pain pills. They were taking anything they could get their hands on. So that meant that there was a lot of neglect for me and my sister Esther. But you know, the one thing I want to say is like, I feel like my parents loved me. They were just deeply flawed people with serious drug addictions.
And I find that amazing. Is that something? Is that a feeling you arrived at later, or did you feel that all along?
Yeah, both. You know it's there all along, but it's subconscious, and then you come to understand it as a thing that you speak out loud, and then you're like, yes, oh, I know this. I understand this now.
It's fun. As a reader, I had more sympathy for your mother than your father.
Yes, for sure.
Because it seemed like your father was a classic drug addict dirtbag, but your mother tried.
My mother did try, yeah.
Over and over again, and entered psychiatric wards and all sorts of other things. And in the end, just, you know, it just was not going to happen. How did you develop the perspective that you had as such a young child, too?
The perspective of
like you lived through it, and like you didn't take off, you didn't run away, you certainly went to a lot of places, but you didn't abandon the situation.
I see. So you know, it became so. My mother and father divorced when I'm five. I live with my mother in sort of a failed attempt for a couple of years, and I end up in the Albuquerque Christian Children's Home. So I spent quite a bit of time in an orphanage, as did my sister. And I guess, to answer your question, my mentality was, I was a smart kid, right? I was practical, pragmatic. There's a roof.
Yeah, but you were also,
head.
You had a deep intelligence that came out at an early age.
There was a roof over my head. I was going to public school, and I didn't love the situation I was in. But it was, I guess, tolerable combined with, I didn't see any other options, nor was I like deeply brainstorming a way out of it. So it was a combination of like, this is tolerable combined with just barely combined with grin and bear it, because there's nothing else. That was my mentality. The other thing to keep in mind is kids don't have perspectives like adults, right?
Yeah.
So you're just kind of going with it a little bit. It's all you ever knew.
I totally identify with that, by the way. You end up in Albuquerque, in what was called the war zone. What was that?
So the war zone, before I ended up at the ACCH, the Albuquerque Christian Children's Home, the war zone is a neighborhood. On the map, it's called La Mesa. It's colloquially called by the mayor, the International District. It's a very, very dangerous neighborhood that is basically, so far as I understand it as an external observer, where all the drug users hang out and consume drugs now. It's a very dangerous neighborhood. There's murder. There is bad things happening there. And that was, you know, that was my life as a kid. before I ended up at the orphanage.
Yeah. Well, let's spend a few minutes talking about the orphanage, which really looms as a cinematic sort of element because it's so screwed up. The Albuquerque Christian Children's Home, the ACCH, you described it as an orphanage. What's supposed to happen to the kids that were in there?
So orphanage is a really dated term. I use that term because it feels exactly right to me. I like to use the phrase orphaned by the living. Or my parents were alive, but by no means were they attending to me. So the ACCH is part of a larger trend that people figured out that large institutional living environments are terrible for children, and that the modern approach these days is foster care. Foster care, of course, being one or two, some small number of kids per parental units to approximate a family unit. And so in 1980s, when I was there, the ACCH was meant to be sort of a temporary place where kids could go out of crisis with their families and ultimately either back to their families when the crisis subsides or more likely into foster care. But for some of us, that didn't happen. And I was there for 5 years. So I was basically in this environment where, I had 10 sets of house parents because the job's impossible. So the only thing that's regular are you and the four or five other kids who've been there forever.
And was there a feeling like, God, if I don't get some foster care soon, what are they going to do? Just kick you out?
No, there was never a sense of that. It was more a sense of, again, I was a kid, so I was just tolerating it. But, for example, my sister had a much more developed sense of justice and what should have been happening to us. And she, she was like, why aren't our aunts and uncles taking us? Why aren't our grandparents taking us? Foster care seems great. How come we're not getting adopted? And, what I realized, and I only understood this as an adult, I think my grandparents were keeping us in this institutional environment on the hopes that my mother would get better, or perhaps to actually induce her to get better.
Well, they were the ones that took you on car rides to go visit your mother in the hospital, right?
That's right. Yes.
Which sounded deadly. Absolute silence.
Yeah. No. It was. It's pretty depressing. Psych ward. As a child, I think there's a lot of unclear emotional experiences as you go to see a parental figure in such a place. It was pretty depressing, the whole thing.
Now, the wild thing about your book, among many, is that in the middle of reading stuff like this, and I'm saying this for the benefit of the audience, all of a sudden there'll be you writing about chaos theory or dynamical systems, and that little lecture will just pop out in the middle of this wild story. What an interesting way of talking about the things that interest you.
Yeah. So there's an idea there.
I know that. In fact, I want you to talk about it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So there's a couple of ideas there. Number one, the dynamical systems framework, again, for the audience, I'm a neuroscientist. I think about how the brains are composed of dynamical electrical patterns and how those dynamical electrical patterns lead to the computations that make us who we are, that subserve behavior or thinking or emotions and things like this. And so for me, those mathematical and physical concepts are, I think, a great philosophical framing for a childhood that was completely chaotic. And so the same sort of, a butterfly flaps its wings in Asia and there's a tornado in Texas has the same philosophical underpinning to me as how could I make it out of that kind of environment when other people did not, people very close to me or under very similar circumstances. So that was a philosophical framing. And also, not for nothing, when the material is potentially challenging, giving the reader a buffer before diving back in is also a useful strategy.
It's amazing because through this memoir, you can definitely pinpoint things that happened to you, like specific events, in that if you chose A and not B, your life would have turned out totally differently.
Yes, I completely agree with that, for sure.
And that's extremely sobering.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people, the thing is, especially in, you know, from the perspective of like, you know, what books people like to read or what books sell or are successful or things like this, people really love it when there's a digestible lesson in a book, right? And my digestible lesson is, I don't know how particularly palatable it is. There's a lot of luck in a crazy, huge, dynamical system
right.
of life and earth, and who knows where you end up.
Wow.
I don't think it's quite as dust in the wind as that, but you know, there is an element of it, and a life like my own is a very good way to highlight that.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Cicillo, internationally recognized neuroscientist, and we're talking about his new book, Emergence, a memoir of boyhood, computation, and the mysteries of the mind. David, one of the things I really loved is tracking your development vis-a-vis computer games and then finally PCs. And I want to talk about that a lot because it was so amazing. Now, this time period, personal computers, first of all, video games were really popular and they were just coming out. Talk to me about the first ones you played. I know one of them is Ms. Pac-Man.
Yes. So it was a great blessing of my life to be technically oriented right when all of this was happening. When I saw a video game or played a video game, I don't remember the first time, but early in life, I just became obsessed with them. And it was to be a lifelong passion that ultimately turned into a passion of computers and math and the brain and artificial intelligence. But I was poor. I had a best buddy, Shiloh, in Santa Fe when I was six,
right,
7 years
right.
old. And, you know, we would try to scrounge up a quarter and we would go play. We would like manufacture quarters. We would beg for them. We'd steal them. We'd do whatever. And that was a source of joy, a source of friendship, a source of escape. I even think of, like, you know, learning how to get a high score on one of these old video games is perhaps the first sort of like proto research experience I had in my own mind. How do I do better? That kind of thing.
Yeah, but then eventually you work your way into some of these early, and I love reading about this because I went through this too, the earliest versions of personal computers like Apple IIe's.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your first chance to use an Apple IIe and what it was like for you.
So I guess this would have been fourth or fifth grade. We started going to a computer lab, and there were the Apple IIe's. They were in the public schools.
Oh, man.
And, you know, so like, wow, amazing. So they would pair us up into groups with two kids to a computer. And, of course, I never shared the computer. I was, frankly, a little bit of a shit as a child. And I would just program it. And we had this logo.
Well, wait a minute. Slow down. First of all, programming it at that age, at that stage of development of personal computers, that's no mean feat.
Well, they would teach us how to do it, right? So this little programming language is explicitly designed for kids called Logo,
right,
where you would drive this little cursor around and make pretty patterns. And so there was that. There was the Oregon Trail, which everyone and their mother has played. It's just this fabulous game. So it was all so-called edutainment, right? You learn a little bit of something, but you're enjoying yourself as you're doing it. And that ultimately turned into learning how to program BASIC or Pascal later on in middle school and in high school.
I know you learned the DOS operating system.
Yeah, you have to get around. You have to.
But not every kid around you is doing that.
I don't know. I mean, I have to say, I think there were a lot of kids in the '80s who were tinkering on their parents' computers and having a great time doing it.
And I couldn't believe when I had my first Apple IIe. It was just like incredible the things you could do.
Yes.
I was amazed. As early as the fifth grade in your book, you write that you realized your life wasn't going to amount to anything and you were going to die not having done anything important. And you brought in the Talking Heads song, Road to Nowhere.
Yeah.
And also it was the year that the Challenger disaster happened.
Yes.
That's a pretty heavy thought for a fifth grader.
I was completely unprotected from these kinds of thoughts, which I think are quite common in kids, because I had no parents. I had no one who loved me. I had no one to tell me everything was going to be okay. And so I was, in the modern parlance, I was raw dogging it. I was, I was experiencing everything with complete lack of insulation. And so when I realized I was going to die, it wasn't so much about having complete, you know, having achieved something or not. It was more just the existential dread of realizing yourself is going to perish. It had this enormous impact on me. And I really went into about a 6-month tailspin before I got out of it. And it really, you know, that combined with the sort of like, well, how do I'm also, by the way, in a group home, and how do I fix that?
So right.
This is where my head was at in fourth and fifth grade. It really was.
What's also interesting is reading about how important friends were for you to get you through all this. We talked about Shiloh, and we should talk more about him. And then also people like Omar. What was Shiloh like?
So Shiloh, I basically had, the way I like to say it is, I had 1 year of unabashed, innocent childhood. And that was I was 7 years old in Santa Fe, and I found a best friend, Shiloh, and we just raised hell together. And it was a perfect childhood that many people can relate to, even though we were dirt poor and had no money. I was innocent of that. I didn't understand it, and I had a buddy. So that, you know, that really, I think, developmentally set me up for understanding that tight friendship, even though I wouldn't have used these words as a kid because I didn't understand it on a meta level, that having friends as a kid is a palliative, right? It's and it's protective. So I think because of that, I developed a pattern, because of my friendship with Shiloh, I developed a pattern of seeking out close friends throughout my life as a means of contending with the crazy shit that was going on around me.
We should mention that at the school, at the orphanage, there were major factions of kids, and you seemed to not really be part of them. You had to go cholo adjacent, I think.
That's right.
I love that description in the you're writing about it in the book. Talk about that, because that's hilarious.
Yes. So another example of the kind of vulnerabilities that kids that like me had. I was raised around a lot of cultures. In New Mexico, the predominant races are Caucasian, Mexican, Hispanic, literally the people from Spain who came up 400 years ago, and the different Native American pueblos and cultures.
Did they mix at all? Did they get together?
At the group home, sure.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, because, you know, we're just all sort of cutting up there. And so I became very friendly with a Mexican-American kid, Omar, who was 3 or 4 years older than me. I actually looked up to him probably as a brother, although I never would have I would have never said that in at the time. And, well, you know, he's dressing like a cholo because that's his cultural heritage.
Right.
And he's my older brother. So I'm like, I need to start dressing that way. And I realized about 6 months into it that just wasn't quite.
Didn't they resent that? Did they?
Well, you know, we're all dumb and young, and in middle school, no one resented it. At least not at the group home. I think at school people might have looked at me funny. But anyways, I finally got a crush on a girl, on a white girl, and learned that all of the complexities of culture and race that we contend with in our society. And I started dressing appropriately for my race, as it were.
How did your mother's death affect you? And your mother's death was not unexpected by you. But how did your mother's death really affect you afterwards?
Yeah, so I guess, well, what I would say is, so my mother died when I'm 12. I'm at the group home now for 5 years.
Jeez.
Huge emotional changes to who I am by that point. I actually was quite surprised by her death, even though I knew her trajectory was absolutely going downhill. And it really devastated me, because there's this sort of primacy around the mother-child bond. And even though I hadn't been around her for 5 years, and she'd come visit on weekends here and there, it wasn't like zero contact, but it was minimal. You don't realize a thing is missing until it's gone, kind of thing, right? Like, she was a part of me. I didn't know that was a part of me. So it sent me into a year-long, I would say, depression/anxiety event. Well, you know, I started dissociating a little bit. That's a big word, but I, you know, just like spacing out, not really being part of what's going on, minor panic attacks at school. I became a huge pain in the ass. I mean, behaviorally, I was just hopeless. And so that's what happened. And it was not great.
And then you end up going east.
That's right. So
how did that happen?
Yeah, so my father is one of five kids, and his four siblings, once my mother passed away, they interceded. And I went to live with my aunt and uncle, James and Beverly and James. And so that brought me to the East Coast. That was Virginia. And ultimately, that didn't work out. Well, I was a shithead, and they, you know, it just wasn't going to work. So I ended up at the Milton Hershey School in Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is another, basically, it's a group home, but extremely wealthy. Milton Hershey left his entire.
It was still a tough place to be.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, for sure.
Now
you can have lots of money and still be a group home. Please believe me.
You weren't just difficult. You developed real problems with rage.
I did.
At this point.
Yeah.
That was out of control.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, out of control is a funny phrase. So I had these conversations when I'm 10 with Omar, my big brother at the group home. And because of those conversations, I know that I'm going to go to college.
It's amazing. And it's amazing reading this. You made a decision that you were going to go to MIT.
Yeah, I was going to go to MIT, you know, and I was going to be the smartest person around, and you know, all these things, all these grandiose plans that kids have. Mine were especially grandiose, but I don't feel like it was outside of the realm of how kids think.
No.
So coming back to the point that you make, I was I wasn't out of control in the sense of that mission was something I was preserving, but internally, I had just built up all of this rage, and you know, it came out in incidents in and around animals, and I'm not proud of it. When I was in middle school, but you know, you have to understand the broader context of what's going on.
Yeah,
the crap
yeah.
kicked out of me constantly for years, and all the rest of it. So yes, I was a kid with major emotional problems of the kind you would absolutely expect from living in the kind of organization that I lived in for so long. That is 100% correct.
And the rest of the book, and we're going to run out of time because we only have a few minutes left, is the really you in the process of becoming who you are today, whole. And it took a lot of work. I mean, you had decades of psychoanalysis. And the amazing thing is you came out the other end.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, I had a crisis after college in terms of having major anxiety attacks. And that sort of put me on the map of like, well, how do I fix that? And, you know, the thing is, like, I sounds funny to say, I never wanted to be messed up. I wanted to be normal. And so that desire really fueled my willingness to work with all the things that were happening to me, mostly internally, endogenously generated.
Like I said, we only have a few minutes left. How did all this experience and the way when you look back on your life affect your academic work now and your ideas?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Primarily, I got into neuroscience because I wanted, you know, after I'd sort of gotten myself into a stable state by my mid-20s, I wanted to, it sounds cheesy, make the world a better place, understand the human condition, you know, and so given my technical gifts, I thought that neuroscience would be a nice combination of both my interest in understanding the human condition with my ability to do mathy, sciencey things. And the other thing the way that I would answer that question is that I think my background, it was like so volatile and so in many ways rich because of that.
Right.
I feel like my creative juices are get flowing very easily, and that's very helpful in science.
So like instead of the rage coming out, it's creative.
Yeah, exactly. Sublimated rage, perhaps you'd say.
But it's now again, we only have 1 minute left, but one of the most fascinating things is your afterword. You actually write about AI at the end of this book.
Yeah.
That was unexpected.
Yeah. So my thinking was, I'm basically telling two stories in this memoir. One is the story of my life, and the other story is how AI came from studying brains.
Yeah,
and that's what I did.
Yeah.
So it all wraps together. And so at the end of the story of my story, you get the climax, you get the denouement. And so the afterword is an attempt to give the same treatment to the technical story that comes along in the book, namely, you know, my thinking about where AI is going and how it's going to help us, the things we need to worry about, and so forth.
So you're not anti-AI at all?
No, I'm not. I think there are real concerns. I don't want to minimize them.
You don't think it needs to be regulated?
Ooh.
I know. That's a story for another time.
That's right. That's a story.
That's a big discussion. I'm sorry I sprang it on you.
Yeah. I'll leave it at, ooh, that's a big discussion.
It is. And actually, that's the next book you should write.
That's right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's been great. My guest tonight has been David Cicillo, internationally recognized neuroscientist. And we've been talking about his new book. It's really a powerful book. It's an amazing book in many ways. Emergence, a memoir of boyhood, computation, and the mysteries of the mind. David, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.